Be sure your ears are open and your eyes are peeled, and keep your wits about you. It is the only way. Then you will know when the right moment comes, as in, aha, now is the time. You are a brave, smart girl, my friend. Just stay alert. Maria nodded. I have to be a brave, smart girl, she thought. I wish my friends all the very best, the commendatore said, encouraging her. Then, as if by afterthought, and worry not, my friends. Your chest will soon fill out. Enough to fill a C-cup bra? The commendatore gave an embarrassed shrug. I fear I am a mere idea. I know not how the undergarments of women are measured, but all the same, I can assure you that your breasts will grow. No need to worry. Time is the remedy for your concerns. It is the key for all things that possess form. True, time does not last forever, but as long as you have it, it is remarkably efficacious. So look forward to the future, my friends. Thank you, Maria said. It was certainly good to hear. She needed every bit of support to be the brave girl she knew she had to be. Then the commendatore vanished, again like vapor into thin air. The silence around her deepened the moment he was gone. The thought that she might never see him again left her sad and lonely. I have no one to rely on now, she thought. She sprawled out on the bare mattress and stared at the ceiling. It was low and made of white plasterboard. In its exact center was a fluorescent light, but of course she couldn't turn it on. That was a definite no-brainer. How long would she be stuck in this room? It was almost dinner time. If she wasn't home by 7:30, her aunt would call the Arts and Culture Center. They would inform her that she'd been absent that day. The thought hurt. Her aunt would be hysterical, terrified that something bad had happened to her. Somehow, she needed to let her know she was all right. Then she remembered. There was a cell phone in the pocket of her school blazer. She had left it turned off. She pulled it out and switched it on. The words low battery flashed on the screen. A split second later, the screen went black. Her phone was dead. She could hardly blame the phone. She hadn't used it in ages. She seldom needed it in her daily life and had little interest in or affection for cell phones. So no surprise the battery was drained. She heaved a sigh. She should have recharged it once in a while at least, just in case something happened. But there was no use crying over spilt milk. She stuck the cell phone back in her blazer pocket. But something had caught her attention, and she pulled it out again. The plastic penguin attached to it was gone. It had been her lucky charm since she had won it on points at a donut shop. The strap must have broken. But where on earth could she have dropped it? It was hard to imagine. She hardly ever took it out of her pocket. At first, she felt uneasy without her lucky charm. Then she thought some more. Her own carelessness was probably to blame for losing it. But a new kind of talisman had appeared in its place. That closet full of clothes. And those clothes had protected her. And that little man with the funny way of talking, the commendatore, had led her to this place. So something, she thought, is still looking out for me. No need to mope about the missing penguin. Maria wasn't carrying much. Wallet, handkerchief, change purse, house key, and a half a pack of cool mint gum. That was about it. Her shoulder bag contained pencils and pens and a few school textbooks. None were likely to be very useful. She slipped out of the maid's room and went to check the storage room. As the commendatore had said, it was stocked with provisions in case of earthquake. The ground was comparatively stable in this mountainous part of Odawara, so an earthquake shouldn't be that serious. The great Kanto earthquake of 1923 had devastated the city of Odawara, but here in the hills, the damage had been relatively minor. She'd done a summer project in grade school on the impact of the earthquake on the Odawara region. Nevertheless, it would be very difficult afterward to get food and water way up here. Thus, Manshiki had taken pains to stock up on both. His caution knew no bounds. She selected two bottles of mineral water, a box of crackers, and a bar of chocolate, and carried them back to her room. She was pretty sure Manshiki wouldn't miss such a small amount. However meticulous he might be, he wouldn't keep tabs on how many bottles he had stored. The water was necessary because she didn't want to turn on the tap in her room if at all possible. That would make the pipes in the house gurgle. It is best to make as little noise as possible, the commendatore had said. She had to be careful. Maria returned to the maid's room and locked the door from the inside. In a sense, it was a useless gesture, since Manshiki had keys to all the rooms in the house, yet it might earn her a little time. At the very least, it eased her mind a bit. She wasn't hungry at all, but she ate a few crackers and drank some of the water just to check. The crackers were mediocre, as was the water. She checked the labels. Neither had reached its best before date. I'm okay, she thought. I won't starve. Outside was now completely dark. She pulled the curtain back a little farther and looked across the valley. She could see her house. She couldn't see what was going on inside without the binoculars, but she could tell lights were burning in some of the rooms. If she looked hard, she might be able to observe someone moving around. Her aunt was there, freaking out, she was sure, because she hadn't come home. Wasn't there a way to call her? Manshiki must have a phone somewhere. All she had to do was say, "Please don't worry, I'm all right," and hang up. If she kept it short, Manshiki probably wouldn't find out. But her room had no phone, nor had she seen one in that part of the house. Could she escape under cover of darkness? Find a ladder somewhere and scale the wall to freedom? She recalled seeing a fold-up ladder in the garden shed. Then she recalled the commendatore's words, "This place is kept under tight guard, in more than one way." She was pretty sure that tight guard didn't refer to the security company's alarm system alone. I should believe the commendatore, Maria thought. This is no normal place. Many things are lurking about. I have to be super cautious, super patient. This is no time to be rash or willful. I should sit back and wait for the right opportunity, like the commendatore said. You will know when the right moment comes, as in, aha, now is the time. You are a brave, smart girl, my friends. Just stay alert. That's right. I have to be a brave, smart girl. Survive all this in good shape, and then watch my breasts get bigger and bigger. So she thought as she lay there on the bare mattress. All around was growing darker. She could tell that darkness of a different order was about to arrive. Chapter 62. One can stumble into a labyrinth. Time followed its own principles, paying no heed to her thoughts. She lay there on the bare mattress in her little room, watching it sluggishly shuffle past. She had nothing else to do. It would be nice to have a book to read, she thought, but there were no books at hand, and even if there had been, she couldn't switch on the light. All she could do was lie there in the dark. She had found flashlights and spare batteries in the storeroom, but had decided to use those as little as possible. The night deepened, and she fell asleep. She was nervous and apprehensive in such an unfamiliar place, and she wanted to stay awake, but at a certain point fatigue overcame her and she dropped off. She simply couldn't keep her eyes open. The coverless bed was cold, so she took a quilt and blankets from the closet, wrapped herself up in them like a Swiss roll, and closed her eyes. There was no space heater in the room, and she couldn't use the central system for obvious reasons. A note here on the time frame. Menshiki would have left to visit me while Maria was asleep. He stayed over and went back the following morning. In other words, he wasn't at home that night. The house was empty. But Maria had no way of knowing that. Maria woke up once that night to use the bathroom, but didn't flush the toilet. During the day was one thing, but in the still wee hours of the morning, the sound of running water could attract attention. Menshiki was without question a cautious and meticulous individual. He would notice even the slightest change, so why risk discovery? Her watch said 2 in the morning. Saturday morning, that was. Friday had passed. When she peeped through the curtain, she could see her home across the valley. The lights in the living room were blazing. It was after midnight, and she still hadn't returned, so the people there, at night, that would mean her father and her aunt, were unable to sleep. "I've done an awful thing," Maria thought. She even felt sorry for her father, very rare for her. "I shouldn't have been so reckless. It wasn't my intention. This is what I get for acting so impulsively." Yet, whatever her regrets, however much she might blame herself, she couldn't transport herself across the valley. She was not a crow. She couldn't sprout wings and fly through the air, nor could she disappear and reappear like the Commendatore. She was confined within her still growing body and shackled by time and space. Hers was a clumsy, awkward existence. Look at her chest, as flat as a board. Her breasts still pancakes that had failed to rise. Naturally, Maria was scared alone there in the dark. Her powerlessness pained her. She wished the Commendatore were there. She had so many things to ask him. Whether he answered them or not, at least she would have someone to talk to. To be sure, his way of speaking was odd, somewhat different from modern Japanese, but she could still understand his general meaning. But he might never come back. "There is another place I must go, and another task I must look after," he had told her. She was desolate to have lost him, perhaps forever. From outside the window came the resonant cry of a night bird. It sounded like an owl, perhaps a horned owl. They were cloistered in the dark forests, honing their wisdom. "I must be as wise as they are," she thought. "Be a smart, brave girl." But sleep overtook her a second time. She couldn't keep her eyes open. Pulling the bedding around her once again, she lay down on the mattress and closed her eyes. It was a deep and dreamless sleep. When she woke up, it was already growing light outside. Her watch said 6:30. The world was welcoming a new Saturday. Maria spent all that day holed up in the maid's room. In place of breakfast, she had more crackers, a few chocolates, and mineral water. She crept into the gym and borrowed several issues from a small mountain of Japanese editions of National Geographic. She guessed Menshiki read them when he was working out on his exercise bike, since they were stained here and there with what appeared to be his sweat. She read through them several times. There were articles on the habitat of the Alaskan wolf, the mysteries of the rising and ebbing of the tides, the life of the Inuit, and the gradual shrinking of the Amazon rainforest. Not Maria's usual reading material by any means, but now, with nothing else to look at, she read them over and over until she had them practically memorized. She bored holes in the illustrations with her eyes. When she tired of reading, she napped. On occasion, she looked through the curtain at her home across the valley. "I wish I had that telescope now," she thought. "Then I'd really be able to see inside. even watch people moving around. She wanted to be back inside her room with the orange curtains, scrub every inch of her body in a nice hot bath, change into fresh pajamas, and curl up in her warm bed with her cat. Just after 9 in the morning, she heard the sound of someone coming down the stairs. The footsteps of a man in slippers. Menshiki, most likely. His way of walking was somehow distinctive. She wanted to peek through the keyhole, but the door didn't have one. She huddled over her knees in a corner of the room, her body rigid. Escape would be impossible if he opened the door and came in. The commendatore had said that shouldn't happen, and she had taken him at his word. But nothing was 100% sure thing in this world. Making herself as invisible as possible, she thought of the clothes in the closet and prayed, "Don't let anything happen to me." Her throat was as dry as cotton. Menshiki seemed to have brought down his dirty laundry. He probably washed a day's worth of clothes at this time each morning. He tossed them in, added detergent, set the timer and mode, and turned the washer on. She could tell by listening that his movements were practiced. She was surprised how well she could hear. The washer began to churn. Menshiki then moved to the gym and began working out on his exercise machines. That seemed to be his ritual, to work out while his clothes were spinning in the washer, while listening to classical music. She could hear strains of Baroque music coming from the speakers attached to the gym's ceiling. It sounded like Bach, or Handel, or Vivaldi. Maria didn't know much about classical music, though, so it could have been any one of those three. Maria spent a full hour with her ears tuned to the churn of the washer, the systematic whirring of the exercise machines, and the music of either Bach, Handel, or Vivaldi. It was a nerve-wracking hour. True, Menshiki probably wouldn't notice that his pile of National Geographics was short a few issues, or that his stash of crackers and chocolate in the storeroom was shrinking bit by bit. She had taken only a tiny fraction of what he had laid away. Nevertheless, there was no telling what might happen. She had to guard against carelessness, to stay on her toes. Eventually, a buzzer went off, and the washer stopped. Menshiki walked slowly back to the laundry room, took the clothes from the washer, put them in the dryer, and turned it on. The dryer began to turn. Satisfied that all was in order, Menshiki ambled up the stairs. It appeared that his workout had ended. Now he would probably take a long shower. Maria closed her eyes and sighed with relief. Menshiki would likely come back down in an hour or so to remove his clothes from the dryer. Yet the most dangerous period had passed. At least it felt that way. He hadn't sensed her hiding there in the room, hadn't felt her presence at all. She could breathe more freely now. Then who had it been in front of the closet? The commendatore had said it was Menshiki, but then again it wasn't him at all. What had that meant? She couldn't understand what he had been trying to say. It was just too difficult for her. Whatever the case, that someone had been able to tell that she, or at least a person, was in the closet. They had sensed her there, no doubt. Yet, for some reason, that someone was unable to open the closet door. What could that reason have been? Had that assembly of beautiful old clothes really protected her? She longed to ask the commendatore, but he had gone off somewhere. There was no one left who could explain things to her. Menshiki did not set foot outside the house all that Saturday. As far as she knew, the garage door hadn't opened, nor had a car engine started up. He had come down to pick up his laundry, and then walked slowly back up the stairs. That was it. No one had visited the house at the top of the hill where the road came to an end. No parcels or registered documents had been delivered. The doorbell had remained silent. She had heard the telephone ring twice. The ring was faint and distant, but she could still make it out. It was picked up on the second ring the first time, and the third ring the time after that. That was how she knew Manshiki was in the house. The town garbage truck crawled up the slope to the melody of Annie Laurie, and then crawled back down again. Saturday was garbage pickup day. Otherwise, she heard no sounds. The house was perfectly still. The morning passed, afternoon rolled on, and soon evening was drawing near. A second note on the time frame. While Maria was hiding in the maid's tiny room, I killed the Commendatore in the Izu nursing home, tied up Longface, and descended into the underworld. But she never found the perfect time to escape. She had to be patient and wait for the right moment, the Commendatore had told her. You will know when the right moment comes. As in, aha, now is the time. However, the right moment never came. Maria grew more and more tired of waiting. Patience was not her strength. How long, she wondered, must I stay holed up here? Manshiki began playing the piano not long before nightfall. Apparently, he kept the living room window open when he practiced, so Maria could hear the music in her hiding place. It sounded like Mozart. One of his sonatas in a major key. She had noticed the score on the piano. Manshiki ran through the slow-paced movement, then went back to repeat several sections, adjusting his fingering until he was satisfied. It was difficult, though, and he seemed to be having trouble balancing the sound. For the most part, Mozart's sonatas aren't all that hard, but a pianist who tries to master one can stumble into a labyrinth. That labyrinth, however, didn't seem to faze Manshiki in the least. Maria listened to him patiently walk back and forth over the thorny passages. He practiced that way for about an hour. At the end, he closed the lid with a bang. She sensed he was frustrated, but not all that much. Rather, it was a moderate, elegant frustration. Even when he was alone, or at least when he thought he was alone, in his sprawling mansion, he kept a tight rein on his feelings. What followed was a repeat of the previous day. The sun set, the sky darkened, and the crows flew cawing back to their nests in the mountains. One by one, the lights of the houses across the valley went on. The Akikawa's lights did too, and stayed lit even after midnight. Those lights signaled to Maria just how worried her family was. At least it felt that way to her. It hurt not to be able to ease their pain. In stark contrast, not a single light went on at Tomohiko Amata's house, in short, the house I inhabited. To all appearances, it looked abandoned. Night came, yet it remained black. It seemed that no one was home. Maria thought it strange. Where had her teacher gone? Did he know that she was missing? At a certain hour, sleep again attacked Maria. The Sandman showed no mercy. Shivering in her school blazer, she wrapped herself in blankets and quilts and closed her eyes. I wish my cat were here, she thought as she drifted off. For some reason, her cat, it was a she, seldom mewed or yowled. She only purred. Maria could have kept her with her without fear of discovery, but of course she wasn't there. Maria was all alone, in a small pitch-black room with no means of escape. Sunday morning dawned. When Maria opened her eyes, it was still quite dark. Her watch said before 6. The days were getting shorter. Rain was falling outside, a hushed winter rain. She didn't realize it was raining until she noticed water dripping off the branches. The air in the room was chilly and damp. If only she had a sweater, she thought. All she was wearing under her blazer was a thin knitted vest, a cotton blouse, and beneath that a t-shirt. An outfit for a warm afternoon. A wool sweater would sure come in handy. Then she remembered she'd seen a sweater in that closet. An off-white cashmere that looked nice and warm. She could trot up the stairs and get it, put it under her blazer, and she'd be warm as toast. But slipping out the door and climbing the stairs was just too dangerous, especially to that room. She had to make do with what she had on. After all, this cold wasn't unbearable, nothing like the brutal cold the Inuit had to deal with. This was the outskirts of Odawara in early December. Yet the rainy winter morning chilled her to the bone. She could feel the icy damp seep into her body. So Maria closed her eyes and turned her thoughts to Hawaii instead. When she was small, she and her aunt's old school friend had visited Hawaii. They rented a small surfboard for her on the beach at Waikiki, and she played in the waves. When she tired of that, she basked in the sun on the white sand. It was so warm and so harmonious. High above her, the fronds of the palms swayed in the trade winds. White clouds sailed out to sea. She lay there and sipped a glass of lemonade, so cold her temples hurt. Maria remembered the trip in detail. Would she ever see a place like that again? She'd give anything for that chance. Once again, a little after 9, Manshiki came padding down the stairs in his slippers. The washer started, the classical music kicked in, this time it sounded like a Brahms symphony, and the rhythm of the exercise machines began. This lasted a full hour, a perfect repeat of the day before. Only the composer was different. The master of the house was certainly a creature of habit. He transferred the laundry from the washer to the dryer and returned exactly an hour later to pick it up. He didn't come downstairs after that and showed no interest at all in the maid's room. Another note on the time frame. Then Shiki went to my home that afternoon, where he bumped into Masahiko and they had a brief conversation. For some reason, though, Maria was again unaware that he had left the house. Manshiki's unwavering routine was useful to Maria. She could prepare herself emotionally and plan her movements in advance. Unexpected events would have made it much harder on her nerves. She had grown familiar with Manshiki's pattern and adapted herself to it. He almost never went out, at least to her knowledge. He worked in his study, washed his own clothes, cooked his own meals, and, in the evening, sat down in front of his Steinway and practiced. Sometimes there was a phone call, but those were infrequent. She could count them on her fingers. For some reason, he didn't seem to like phones all that much. He appeared to take care of his work-related communications, she had no idea how extensive they were, on the computer in his study. Manshiki took care of the basic cleaning, but once a week he had a cleaning service come to him. Maria remembered him mentioning that on their previous visit. "I don't mind doing it myself," he had said. "Cleaning can cheer me up, just like cooking." But it was clearly beyond him to keep such a big house tidy on his own, thus the need for professional help. He had said he left the house for half a day when they came. What day of the week would it be? "Maybe that's when I can make my getaway," Maria thought. "People will be bringing equipment, so the gate should be opening and closing as their vehicles come and go. Manshiki should be absent, so getting out might not be all that hard. That could be my one and only chance." Yet there was no sign that the cleaners were coming. Monday was much the same as Sunday. Manshiki was making good progress with Mozart. His mistakes were fewer, and the whole piece was coming together musically. He was a careful and patient man. Once he set a goal, he stuck to it. Maria had to admit she was impressed. Even if he could make it through without a hitch, though, how pleasing would his Mozart be to the ear? Listening to what was coming from upstairs, she had her doubts. She was surviving on crackers, chocolate, and mineral water. She also polished off an energy bar full of nuts and a can of tuna fish. Since she had no toothbrush, she brushed her teeth with mineral water using her finger. She read issue after issue of the Japanese version of National Geographic. In the process, she learned about a number of further topics: the man-eating tigers of Bengal, the lemurs of Madagascar, the shifting topography of the Grand Canyon, natural gas extraction in Siberia, the life expectancy of the penguins of Antarctica, the world of the highland nomads of Afghanistan, the grueling initiation rituals of New Guinean youth. She learned the basics about AIDS and Ebola. Such miscellaneous information about nature might prove useful one day. Then again, it might be entirely useless. Whatever the case, no other books were on hand. She devoured back issues of National Geographic like there is no tomorrow. Once in a while, she would slip her hand under her t-shirt to check the status of her breasts. But they didn't appear to be growing at all. If anything, they seemed to be getting smaller. She was also concerned about her period. According to her calculations, the next was due in about 10 days. She had found nothing related to that condition in the storeroom. Plenty of toilet paper was stockpiled in case of earthquake, but no sanitary napkins or tampons. It seemed that women and their needs didn't register with the owner of the house. She'd be in big trouble if it started while she was in hiding. Probably, though, she would have escaped by then. Probably. It was hard to imagine putting up with another 10 days of this. The cleaners finally showed up on Tuesday morning. She could hear the lively chatter of women in the upper garden as they unloaded equipment from the back of their van. Manshiki had not done his laundry that morning, nor performed his exercise routine. In fact, he hadn't come downstairs at all. She had wondered if this could be why Manshiki wouldn't change his daily schedule without a reason, and, sure enough, it was as she had guessed. Manshiki had probably driven his Jaguar out the gate at the same moment the cleaner's big van pulled in. Maria rushed to tidy up the maid's room. She gathered the empty water bottles and cracker packets and put them in a garbage bag, which she set out in a visible place. The cleaners would look after it. She neatly folded the blanket and quilt and returned them to the closet. She took care to erase every trace of her presence. Now no one could tell that someone had been living there for days. Then she slung her bag over her shoulder and crept up the stairs. Timing her moves, she darted through the hallway without attracting the cleaner's attention. Her heart pounded at the thought of the dangers of that room. At the same time, though, she missed the clothes hanging in its closet. She wanted to go back for one last look, touch them with her hands, but there was no time for that. She had to hurry. She slipped through the front door undetected and ran up the curved driveway. The gate had been left open, as she had anticipated. It made no sense for anyone working there to open and close it each time they passed through. Her face as she stepped out onto the road was a picture of normality. "Should I really be able to leave this easily?" she thought outside the gate. "Shouldn't I have to pay a higher price? Go through some sort of painful rite of passage, like the teenage tribesmen of New Guinea? Endure a ritual like that as a badge of courage?" Those thoughts did not linger, however. They were dwarfed by the liberation she felt at having made her getaway. The day was overcast, with low-lying clouds that threatened cold rain at any minute, but Maria's face was raised to the sky, as if she were on the beach at Waikiki, gazing up at the swaying palm trees. She took several deep breaths, giddy with her good fortune. "I am free," she thought. "My feet will take me anywhere I want to go. My nights spent trembling in the dark are over." That fact alone made her grateful to be alive. It had been only 4 days, but now the world appeared so fresh. Each tree, every blade of grass, charged with such wonderful vitality. She found the smell of the wind exhilarating. Yet this was no time to dawdle. Manshiki could have forgotten something and come driving back at any time. I should get away from here, she thought, and fast. Adopting what she hoped was a nonchalant expression, Maria tried to smooth her wrinkled school uniform, she had been sleeping in it for days, and straighten her hair to avoid arousing suspicion as she trotted down the mountain. At the foot of the slope, she turned up the road on the other side, but she did not take her usual route home. Rather, she headed for my place. She had something in mind, but the house was empty. She rang the bell repeatedly, but no one came to the door. Giving up, she went around to the back and took the path through the woods to the pit behind the little shrine. Now, however, a blue plastic sheet covered the pit. The sheet hadn't been there before. It was held firmly in place by cords attached to stakes driven into the ground. Stone weights were lined up on top. It was no longer possible to peek inside. In her absence, someone, who she didn't know, had sealed it. Probably they considered it a safety hazard. She stood in front of the pit and listened for a while, but she heard nothing. My note, the fact she didn't hear the bell could have meant that I hadn't arrived yet, or possibly that I had fallen asleep. Cold drops of rain began to fall. I should go home, she thought. My family is worried about me. But how could she explain the last 4 days? She had to think of something. She couldn't let on that she had been hiding at Manshiki's all that time. That was out of the question. It would create an even bigger mess. The police had probably been notified of her disappearance. If they knew that she had broken into Manshiki's home, she'd be charged with trespassing. She would be punished. What if she claimed that she had fallen into the pit by accident and had been unable to get out for 4 days? That only when her teacher, me, in other words, came by, was she able to climb to safety? Maria had expected me to play along with this scenario, but I hadn't been home, and the pit's opening had been secured with a plastic tarp. Thus, her plan fell through. Had that scenario unfolded, I would have had to explain to the police why Manshiki and I had brought in heavy equipment to uncover the pit, which might have led to even thornier problems. Claiming temporary amnesia was the only other story she could think of. Nothing else came to mind. She would say that those 4 days were a blank, that she couldn't remember a thing, that when she came to, she was lying alone on the mountain. She would stick with that. There was no other way. She had seen a TV show that hinged on that idea. She wasn't sure if people would swallow an excuse like that. The police and her family would grill her. They might send her to a psychiatrist or counselor of some kind. Even so, a claim of amnesia was the only option. She would have to mess up her hair, splatter mud on her legs and arms, and add a few scattered cuts and bruises to make it look as if she had spent all that time in the mountains. It would be an act she would have to carry through to the very end. And in fact, that was what she did. It was hardly a masterful performance, but she could come up with no alternative. This was what Maria revealed to me. She had just finished her account when Shoko Akikawa returned. I heard her Toyota Prius pull up in front of my house. I think you should keep quiet about what really happened, I said to Maria. Don't tell anyone but me. It will be our secret. Of course, Maria said. Of course I won't tell anyone. Even if I did, they wouldn't believe me. I believe you. Does this mean the circle is closed? I don't know, I said. Maybe not all the way, but I think we can rest easy. The dangerous part is over.
The virulent part?
That's right, I said. The virulent part. Maria studied my face for a full 10 seconds.
The Commendatore, she said in a small voice. He really exists.
That's right, I replied. He really does. And I killed him with these hands, really. But of course, I couldn't tell her that.
Maria gave a single nod. I knew she would keep our secret. It was a secret we would share forever. I wished I could have told Maria that the clothes that had protected her from that something had been worn by her late mother before she married, but I couldn't. I didn't have the right. Neither did the Commendatore. There was but one person in the world who did, and that was Manshiki. But he would never exercise it. We all live our lives carrying secrets we cannot disclose. Chapter 63. But it's not what you're thinking. Maria and I had a secret. An important secret shared by the two of us alone. I described my time in the underworld, and she told me exactly what had happened to her at Manshiki's mansion. We wrapped up the two paintings, Killing Commendatore and The Man with the White Subaru Forester, as tightly as we could, and stored them in the attic of Tomohiko Amada's house. Nobody else knew about that, either. The owl did, of course, but it wasn't going to talk. It would hold our secret in perfect silence. Maria came to visit from time to time. She hid it from her aunt using her secret passageway. We put our heads together to try to figure out what our experiences had in common, comparing the timelines right down to the smallest detail. At first, I worried that Shoko would suspect that Maria's 4-day disappearance and my 3-day long-distance trip were somehow related, but the idea seems never to have entered her head. Nor did the police direct their attention to that coincidence. They were ignorant of the passageway, so they dismissed my home as just another house on the next ridge over. Since I did not number among the Akikawa's neighbors, they never came to interview me. Nor did it appear that Shoko had told them I was painting Maria's portrait. She probably didn't see it as relevant. Had the police put Maria's absence and my trip together, I could have been placed in a delicate situation. I never completed my portrait of Maria Akikawa. It was almost done, but I feared where finishing it might lead. Manshiki, for one, would move heaven and earth to put his hands on it. That much was clear, no matter what he might say to the contrary. I had no intention, however, of letting him install the painting in his private sanctuary. That could be dangerous. So in the end, I left it unfinished. Maria, however, loved the painting. It shows how I think these days, was how she put it, and wanted to keep it near her if possible. So I readily gave it to her in its unfinished state, along with the 3 sketches I had promised earlier. I think it's cool, Maria said. It's a work in progress, and I'm a work in progress too, now and forever. None of us are ever finished. Everyone is always a work in progress. How about Mr. Manshiki? Maria asked. He looks very finished to me. I think he's a work in progress too, I said. Manshiki was far from being a completed human being, from what I could tell anyway. That is why, night after night, under cloak of darkness, he reached out to Maria Akikawa across the valley on his high-powered binoculars. He couldn't help himself. That secret allowed him to maintain some sort of personal equilibrium. It was for him the equivalent of the long balancing pole that tightrope walkers carry. Of course, Maria was aware that Manshiki was peeking into her house, but she never revealed it to anyone, apart from me. She never told her aunt. What possessed him to do something like that? It mystified her. Yet for some reason, she didn't feel like pursuing it any further. All she did was keep her curtain closed. The sun-bleached orange curtain stayed tightly shut at all times. She also made sure that the light in her room was off when she changed for bed at night. Elsewhere in the house, however, his voyeurism didn't bother her. Sometimes, she even thought she enjoyed it. Perhaps she found some meaning in the fact that she alone knew what was going on. According to Maria, Shoko and Minshiki were still seeing each other. Her aunt would jump in the car and drive off to his house once or twice a week. Their relationship appeared to be sexual. Maria hinted at this in a very roundabout way. Her young aunt never said where she was going, but Maria knew. When she came back, her complexion was rosier than usual. In any case, whatever the nature of that peculiar void within Minshiki, Maria was powerless to interfere in their affair. She could only let them continue on as they were. All she wished was not to be drawn into whatever was going on between the two of them, that she be allowed to stand at a safe distance outside the whirlpool of their relationship. I doubted that she could pull that off. Without realizing it, she would be sucked in sooner or later to a greater or lesser degree, from the periphery, unavoidably toward the center. Minshiki was wooing Shoko Akikawa, but always with Maria in mind. Whether he had planned it all from the start or not, he couldn't help himself. That's the kind of man he was. And, like it or not, I had brought them together. He had met Shoko in this house. That's what he had wanted. And when Minshiki wanted something, the guy knew how to put his hands on it. Maria wasn't sure what Minshiki would do with that closet full of shoes and size 5 dresses. She guessed he would keep them, whether they were stored in that closet or in another place. However his relationship with Shoko Akikawa turned out, he wouldn't be able to discard them or burn them. That was because the wardrobe had become a part of his psyche. The clothes would be forever enshrined within his spiritual sanctuary. I decided to quit teaching my painting class near Odawara Station. "I'm sorry, but I need to focus on my art," was how I put it to the director. He took it in stride. "It's a shame," he said. "Everyone says you're a wonderful teacher." His words didn't sound altogether false either. I thanked him and promised to stick it out till year's end. By then, he had located a good replacement, a retired high school art instructor in her mid-60s. She struck me as a very nice woman, with eyes that resembled those of an elephant. Minshiki called from time to time. No practical matter was ever involved. We just chatted. Each time he would ask if there had been any change in the pit behind the shrine, and each time I would tell him no, there hadn't. That was the honest truth. The blue plastic sheet was still stretched across the opening. I went to check sometimes when I was out for a walk, but never saw any sign that it had been tampered with. The stones holding it down hadn't been moved either. There were no more strange or suspicious events connected to the pit. I never heard the bell in the middle of the night, nor did the commendatore, or anything else, emerge from it. It was just a big hole sitting quietly in the middle of the woods. The clump of tall pampas grass, flattened by the backhoe, was growing back, concealing the area around the pit once again. As far as Minshiki knew, I had been in the pit the whole time I was missing. True, he couldn't explain how I had gotten inside, yet he had found me there. That was an indisputable fact. As a result, he never connected Maria's disappearance and mine. He could only see the overlap of the two events as some kind of strange coincidence. Discreetly, I probed to see if he had an inkling that someone had been hiding in his house for 4 days, but he had seen no telltale signs. He was wholly in the dark, in which case, whoever had been standing outside the closet in the forbidden chamber was most likely not him. But then, who had it been? Although Minshiki called, he no longer came by for visits. Perhaps he no longer needed to hang out now that Shoko was in his grasp. Or maybe he had lost interest in me. Or both. It didn't matter to me one way or the other, though there were times I missed the sound of his Jaguar V8 purring up the slope. Nevertheless, the occasional phone calls, always before 8 in the evening, suggested that Minshiki felt we should stay connected in some way. Perhaps the fact that he had revealed to me that he might be Maria's biological father weighed on his mind to some extent. I don't think he worried that I would blurt it out to either Maria or Shoko Akikawa somewhere down the line. He was sure I would guard his secret. He could read me well enough to know that, like he could read all people. Yet it was so foreign to Manshiki to have bared his heart to anyone, whoever they might be. He had an iron will, but maybe even he found it exhausting to keep secrets to himself all the time. He must have really needed me on his side when he made his confession, and I had struck him as relatively harmless. Whether or not he had exploited me from the beginning, however, I still owed him my gratitude. It was he who had rescued me from the pit. Had he not come along, if he hadn't lowered the ladder and then yanked me up to the surface, I would have become a dried-up corpse. In a sense, then, Manshiki and I had each placed our lives in the other's hands. That meant that our accounts were even. Manshiki just nodded when I told him that I had given a portrait of Maria Akikawa to Maria in its unfinished state. I guess he no longer needed the painting that much, though he had commissioned it. Or he saw no meaning in an unfinished work, or his mind was on other things. A few days after Manshiki and I had this conversation, I put a simple frame on the pit in the woods, placed the painting in the trunk of my Corolla, and took it to his house. This was the last time we would meet face to face. "This is for saving my life. Please accept it," I said. He seemed to like the painting a lot. I thought it was pretty good myself. He offered to pay me for it, but I turned him down. I had received too much money from him as it stood. There was no need for further obligations on either side. We had become neighbors who lived across the valley from each other, no more, and I wanted to keep it that way. Tomohiko Amada passed away the Saturday of the week I was rescued from the pit. He had been in a coma for 3 days, and in the end, his heart simply stopped beating. It shut down quietly and naturally, like a locomotive pulling into the last station. Masahiko was by his side throughout. He called me soon after. "He went peacefully," he said. "That's the way I would like to go." I thought I could even detect a smile. "A smile?" I asked. Maybe it wasn't a true smile, strictly speaking, but that's the way it looked. To me, anyway. "I'm very sorry about your father," I said, choosing my words. "But I'm glad he went peacefully." "He was semi-conscious until midweek, but he didn't seem to want to leave any parting words," Masahiko said. "I guess he had no regrets. He lived his 90 years to the fullest, doing what he wanted to do." "You're wrong," I thought. "He had regrets. In fact, he bore a very heavy burden. Yet only he knew what that burden was. Now there was no one left who knew, and it would remain like that forever." "I'm afraid I'll be out of touch for a while," Masahiko said. "Dad was famous in his own way, which means I have to take care of all kinds of things. I'm the son and heir, so I can't say no. Let's get together and talk after things have settled down a little." I thanked him for taking the trouble to let me know, and we hung up. Tomohiko Amada's death cast an even deeper hush over my home, but that was only natural. He had lived there for a long time, after all. I shared the house with that silence for several days. It was intense, but not unpleasant. You could call it a pure silence, in that it was not connected to anything else. A chain of events had come to an end. That's how it felt, anyway. It was the kind of hush that comes when matters of major importance are finally resolved. One night, about 2 weeks after Tomohiko Amada's death, Maria came to talk to me, stealing to my house in secret like a cautious cat. She didn't stay very long. Her family was keeping close watch on her, so she didn't have the freedom to come and go that she had enjoyed before. My breasts seem to be getting bigger, she said. My aunt and I went shopping for a bra. The stores carry something called a beginner's bra. Did you know that?
No, I said, I didn't. I glanced at her chest but saw nothing new beneath her green Shetland sweater. I don't see much difference, I said.
That's because the padding is thin. If it were any thicker, people would see the change right away and think you stuffed something inside. So you start thin and then work up from there. It's more complicated than I thought.
Maria told me that a female police officer had questioned her at length about where she had been those 4 days. The questioning had been gentle most of the time, yet on occasion the woman had become very firm. But Maria had stuck with her story. She could remember only that she'd been roaming the mountain and had gotten lost. The rest was a complete blank. She thought she'd survived on the mineral water and chocolate she always carried in her school bag. That was all she would say. Otherwise, she kept her mouth clamped shut. She was good at keeping quiet. Once the police were sure that she had not been kidnapped and held for ransom, they took her to a hospital to have her cuts and bruises examined. They wanted to know if she had been sexually abused in any way. When it was clear that no abuse had taken place, the police lost interest. She was just another runaway kid who had gone missing for a couple of days. Hardly a rare occurrence. Maria threw away everything she had been wearing during that time. Her dark blue blazer, checked skirt, white blouse, knitted vest, loafers, everything. She bought a whole new set of school clothes to replace them. She wanted to start fresh. Then she went back to her life as if nothing had happened. The only difference was that she quit attending the painting class. She was too old for the children's class anyway. She hung my unfinished portrait of her on her wall. It was hard to imagine what kind of woman she would grow up to be. Girls of that age can change in the blink of an eye, physically and emotionally. I might not even be able to recognize her in a few years. I was thus very happy to have painted her picture, unfinished though it was, as she was at 13, freezing her image in time. In this real world of ours, after all, nothing remains the same forever. I called my former agent in Tokyo and told him I wanted to go back to portrait painting. He couldn't have been happier. They were always short of skilled artists.
But you told me you were through with the business, didn't you? He said.
I changed my mind, I answered.
Why, exactly, I didn't say. He didn't ask either. I wanted to live without thinking about anything for a while, to let my hands move on their own, churning out normal, commercial portraits one after the other. In the process, I could gain some financial stability. I didn't know how long I could keep that up. I couldn't predict the future, but for the time being, at least, that's what I wanted. To use my hard-won skills without calling up any complicated thoughts, to avoid getting mixed up with ideas or metaphors or anything along those lines, to keep a safe distance from the messy private affairs of the wealthy, mysterious man who lived across the valley, not to be dragged into any more dark tunnels for having brought hidden masterpieces into the light. More than anything, that's what I desired. I met Yuzu. We talked over coffee and Perrier at a cafe not far from her office. Her belly wasn't as big as I had imagined.
You're not planning to marry the father? I asked her right off the bat.
She shook her head.
No, not at the present time.
Why?
I just feel that's for the best.
But you plan to have the child, right?
She gave a little nod.
Of course. Can't turn back now.
Are you living with him?
No, I'm not. Since you left, I've lived alone.
How come?
For one thing, we're not divorced yet.
But I sent you the divorce papers a while ago, signed and sealed, so I assumed we were already divorced.
Yuzu was quiet for a moment.